Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 679.
So, do you have anything to promote besides Giant Bombcast?
This one I pulled specifically here, Fump Fest, which is a all comedy music festival.
Okay.
Do you ever go to Coachella and wish that Dr. Demento had booked it?
You fucking know I do.
You know I want to see Barnes and Barnes, Jonathan Colton, or Paul and Storm.
It's in Wheeling, Illinois, and it's literally 3 days of endless all comedy music. They have comedy dance parties where there's dance music, comedy stuff, which in my mind is just like the woo pinwheel sound with drum beats over it.
They're coming to take me away.
And then they have improv thing where people start throwing subjects. Somebody just does an ongoing song incorporating stuff as people do it out. The Arrogant Worms are headlining this year, but they have a ton of people who have been from the Dr. Mencho show all through it.
Is Bill Frenzer going to be there?
I can only hope.
Do you know Bill Frenzer did Dead Puppies and King of the Clown?
Is he alive?
Yeah, he's still alive. I saw him at the Tomorrow Show like 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's I can only hope then. I legitimately thought that guy was dead.
No,
so I'm like, super
like
glad.
So many puppies he sang about.
That's sort of my thought. Is I imagine that the puppy syndicate got to him.
No,
but June 5th through 7th.
Okay, we're starting a comedy music band called the Puppy Syndicate.
I see. In my mind, it was a men who dress as dogs and do Dream Syndicate covers.
No, you're making it way more complicated than it needs to be. You put five fucking puppies up on a stage, and then it's just like
Hear me out. We put tiny harmonica holders in front of their puppy faces.
Yes. Yeah. Did you see? Do you see?
That'd be
even
the
just saying that.
Thing ever. Oh my god.
It's like our answer to the Harmonicats.
Yes. Or the Acro Cats.
There we go.
Which I played next to. And yes. The Puppy Syndicate.
Well, next year at Fump Fest, look for the Puppy Syndicate.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Katie?
Yes. The most recent episode of Hound Hall with Moshe Kasher is an extra special live one from San Francisco. And it's all about the history of hip hop.
Ooh.
And it's really cool and really interesting. If you listen to hip-hop at all, I suggest you listen to this. It features expert Jeff Chang, who's written a couple books about hip-hop, and comedians Natasha Leggero, W. Kamau Bell, and Kasim Bentley.
Fantastic.
And you can find it now. It's called Hound Tall.
Great. And again, promoting our San Diego Comic-Con shows. Nerdist is going to be doing a bunch of stuff at Comic-Con this year if you're heading down to San Diego in July. And I believe it's... Is it like the 9th, 10th, and 11th? It's somewhere around there. It's like it's the weekend after 4th of July. And so go to funcomfortabletour.com to get tickets for my stand-up show and live Nerdist podcast. This episode is Dexter Holland, who is from the band The Offspring, who... I mean, Offspring was huge when I worked at K-Rock. Huge on the...
On the rotation.
And obviously, The Offspring had a very successful music career... But I was so... Poor Dexter Holland. I pinned him down and I'm like, talk about science! Because he's a scientist.
He's a molecular biologist.
He's getting his PhD in molecular biology. He's always been a science guy. And after the success of the band, he went back and he's probably about a year away from completing his PhD in molecular biology. And he's studying RNA in HIV. I mean, and it's... He does so many fascinating things that, you know, you never would have... Like, you know, bands from when you were growing up, you don't think, oh, that guy's a scientist. Like, he's like, oh, well, they're just... Like, that's what they did. They're bands, and they still do music. But he does all of these things. But he's a really interesting guy and really sweet, too. So it met every expectation that I had chatting with him and exceeded them. So thank you to Dexter Holland. The Offspring has a new single called Coming For You, an upcoming summer tour date, so check those out at offspring.com. And also, he made a hot sauce just because fucking why
which
not?
Which is super good, by the way.
Yeah, which we have here. They sent us a couple. It's called Gringo Bendito.
My favorite diner in the world is in Sunset Beach. It's called the Harbor House, and they have it on every table at the restaurant. It's real
fantastic.
Good on a breakfast burrito.
So this episode, number 679 with Dexter Holland.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
The
were almost undone by a cable that was barely plugged in. I apologize.
Nice.
But you're here. It all worked out.
It was great.
Welcome.
What a journey.
It's nice to meet you. We're going to talk science. I'm very excited to talk science with you.
Uh-oh, you're talking to the wrong guy.
Why?
No, I don't know. A little bit, maybe. our guitar player is very nervous, very bummed that he's not here today.
Why?
Because he's a huge, huge fan of your show.
What?
Yeah.
Well, where is he?
You guys said he couldn't come.
Did we?
I thought the conversation was going to be more about science and technology, and I didn't know.
He's like, you're going on the Nerdist? I want to go. I'm like,
no,
oh, yeah.
Noodles could have come on the Nerdist.
I don't know.
Noodles! Where are you, Noodles?
Next time, maybe. Next
we
time.
We met.
No, he says to say hello.
Poor Noodles.
He's a huge fan.
Oh, Noodles. Noodles, this was outside of my range of knowledge. This would have been a Noodles approved podcast. I am very, very despondent that we were not able to accommodate you. So please send Noodles hugs. You know what? You should tell Noodles if he wants to come to like a Talking Dead or something, or At Midnight or something. He's more than welcome to.
Oh, he would love to.
Anytime.
He'll appreciate the shout out as well.
That's very easy. Excellent. So quick, what are you working on now? What are you working on right now?
New songs?
Yes, new songs.
Yeah.
Definitely talk about the songs, but talk about the songs first, and then I'm just going to start poking your brain about it.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah,
but your story is insane. Your story is insane.
Well, thank you.
Who takes a break from science to then be in a band that is very successful and then says, well, now I'm going to go back and try to cure AIDS. Like, yeah. Who?
It just kind of made sense. Right. Yeah, we did just put out a single. We had a record that came out, I guess, a couple years ago. And instead of staying in the studio and for a year or whatever and putting together a record, we thought, let's just put out a song here and there for a while and keep us happy, keep the kids happy, hopefully. And we're kind of in the middle of that right now, which is great. It's actually been nice not doing a whole album for a little while.
Sure. So. Well, does the concept of an album mean anything anymore?
We've had these discussions in the studio, like, why are we doing this? Because the kid downloads it in 10 minutes and he's on to the next thing, you know? We've gotten these emails as soon as our record comes out. The very day it comes out, they're like, I love it. When's your next record coming out? You know?
Like, but we just did. It took a long time. They're very hard to make.
And, you know, we've even talked to each other, like, people don't digest music that way anymore. It's not really how it is as an album. But we always come back to the fact that, well, you know, we're a rock band, and rock bands make albums, and that's what we're into and what inspired us. So, you know, we'll definitely do another album.
Does it still feel exactly the same as when you guys have a specific dynamic together that is consistent, or do you feel like your process has changed since the 90s?
I think we all kind of know, you know, who each other are, and we get along pretty well. So I don't think anyone's surprised when we get in the studio and like, you came up with this, you know, we all kind of just work with it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So when did you, can you please just walk me through the timeline a little bit? Where you went to school, and then how you first started getting into molecular biology, and then how you decided, I'm going to take a break from... I'm sure you've told the story before, but I would love to just like a little quick hit some timeline.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we all grew up in Garden Grove, basically, Orange mm-hmm. County.
Yep.
And went to high school there and stuff, and I guess three of the four of us all went to the same high school. And
what year was this?
I graduated in 84.
Okay.
Yeah, so all around that
What was the Orange Curtain like in the early 80s?
Yeah. Well, you know, people, when you look at old punk rock movies and stuff, it's supposed to be very boring and very defined and all that stuff. And I think that was kind of true. When you grow up in something, you don't necessarily realize what you're growing up to it. You kind of react to it instinctively, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So what we did is we got into punk rock. It just seemed like the thing to do. I don't know. I didn't think about why so much then. But we were into the Dead Kennedys and Social Distortion. And there were a lot of Orange County bands we really liked, like TSOL and the Adolescents. But, you know, the Ramones, of course, and the Sex Pistols. And we kind of shared that love. And we would go to shows and drink beer on the weekends.
So it was basically – because you must have been a good student.
I did good in school. I came naturally. I don't know. You know, and that's hard when you're a kid too, because you kind of don't want to, like, it makes you stand out in a weird way sometimes. So you're kind of always trying to underplay it, you know, like you'd have a conversation with someone and you'd think of a big word and then you'd try to think of a smaller word so you didn't come across like, you're like some kind of woman hater or something.
Were you trying to use big words?
Right.
Nerd alert. So like, but is it, I mean, when The Offspring first broke, was there that urge to suppress the, like, don't let them know you're a science guy? Or, you know, it's like, it's all thrash rock. Don't let them know about the science part.
Yeah. I think that just came out pretty quickly. And the press people really wanted to go with that a lot. They're like, oh, we got to put Dexter on the cover wearing a lab coat. And, like, they really want to take it
sure
way too far.
That's about as far as they'll dig. Lab coat? Scientists have that.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
So we really kind of wanted to stay away from that, so we kind of downplayed that for a long time.
I think it would be much better to have you in like a silver cowboy suit with a hat riding an mRNA strand. I think maybe that would have been better than
that. Would be awesome.
Code.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to have to get serious with accurate diagrams and, you know, stuff like that.
So, but what's interesting is in kind of, were you still hearing a buzz?
No.
Okay. In writing, you know, when you're writing something, I feel like a lot of times you're expressing what's in your environment, right? So is there hidden science stuff, or is there hidden nerd stuff in the songs that
right.
you know about, but is kind of a, like Easter eggy stuff?
Well, sort of, I guess. I don't know if I really think about it that way. Actually, a lot of things that I think about or I like, I feel like, you know, I couldn't write that because no one else will relate to it. You know, like I like to fly, but I don't really write songs about flying because I don't know how to connect with the average person, you know.
On how to pilot their own jet aircraft.
Yeah, you know. Don't put the altimeter down to 100 feet, stuff like that. You just don't want to go there.
But you understand if you just sang it in the Offspring cadence that people would think you're like, if you sang literally about flying a plane, people would think that it was a metaphor for something. Like, man, this is so deep.
And maybe just go with it, right? There's actually one good story about how the science thing did translate. And so I was in graduate school. I guess we're kind of going back and forth in
yeah.
time here or whatever. But I actually had to pour some Petri dishes. You know what those things are,
yes.
right? And what you do is you take this giant flask. It looks like that. It's called an Erlenmeyer flask,
I'm
right?
I'm familiar, yes.
Okay. And I had to pour a whole bunch of them. And so you fill it up with this stuff that's almost like Jell-O, and you got to get it really, really super hot so it's sterilized. And I had to make so much. I had to make like 200 Petri dishes. So I put these two of them next to each other in this big giant oven that sterilizes it and stuff. And once it gets done, it's super hot and it's really thick. It's really viscous, so it's not going to cool down forever. So I put it under a hood and had the fan on forever. And I touched it 20 minutes later and it's still super hot. I can barely touch it. And I thought, these things are never going to cool down. I got to keep them separated.
I was hoping that's where you were going. I was hoping that's where you were going.
That is the
no, I was
the,
so hoping that's where you were going.
The no shit actual story I've had. And I was like, wow, I like that line. I got to do something with
God
that.
God damn it. See, science can be very profitable.
That's right.
That is fantastic. Did anyone, no one at the time would have thought, oh, the song's about Petri dishes.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. Well, the other part of that story is that I drove to USC every day, and I commuted from Orange County, so I went through some pretty bad neighborhoods on a daily basis, and you saw evidence of the gang life and all that stuff and the graffiti, and so Keep Them Separated became more of a metaphor of gang life.
Yeah. That's good. You turn Petri dishes and you're like, but it's a metaphor for life. It is. That's what I'm saying. If you write about altimeters, then people will think that it's something more.
Maybe something more, right?
When did you get your pilot license?
20 years ago, I guess now.
Really?
Yeah.
And so you're licensed to fly. You have a license to fly like full commercial jet aircraft.
I got rated all the way up to, they call it airline transport. Like I could fly for the airlines, but.
Do you know how amazing it would be if all of a sudden it was like, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain, Dexter Holland speaking, and then you break into a song?
I should totally do that, huh?
How are you able to, I mean, this is one of my favorite things about doing this podcast and talking to people is So much of the time, you see people for a, there's so much to process, and you categorize everyone like, oh, this guy is about this, and this woman's about this, and this person just does this. But to meet you and talk to you and know that not only do you have an extensive science background, and you're currently working on trying to understand HIV, but you also have your you also are a rated pilot at the same time.
Right.
When you very easily could have just said, yeah, fuck you, I'm in The Offspring, and that's it, the end. Like, you could have just done that, and that, and I don't think anyone would have faulted you for that. But so what is it specifically about your personality, and furthermore, your work ethic and your drive that forces you to really take everything as far as you can?
Yeah, I don't know, because it's there. You know, it's one of those things, I guess, right?
I guess.
You probably want a better answer than that.
Well, but if that's really what it is.
I guess I'm interested in stuff. I think stuff is cool, and I just think when I see something I like, I'm like, well, that would be really rad to do that. Why not give it a shot? I guess maybe the problem is I never know when I get into something what a bad idea it usually is, because you're going to be really terrible at it for a long time, or it's going to cost a lot of money or take all your time and stuff, and it takes a while to get over that hump, you know?
Sure.
The band was a good example where it took us 10 years, you know? We were like super into it and really, like I said, inspired by the punk bands and started playing and couldn't get anyone to come to the shows and didn't realize really how terrible we were as a band. We were not good at all for a really long time. We didn't take lessons. We didn't own instruments when we started the band. We literally said, let's start a band. And like, okay, what do you want to play? You know, and show us our instruments on the spot.
Oh, wow.
So that made the curve a little longer.
Right? That is a very fierce learning curve. Like, we have to not just learn the music biz, but learn actually how to play instruments at the same time. So at what point did it go, because with anything that's a craft or something that starts out as fun or a hobby, at a certain point, it does kind of become a chore. Like, it's the maintenance of it and the growing of it more than just the first couple weekends. You're like, oh, fuck, you really got to work at this. Yeah. So how did you guys focus, and what kept you going along the way to keep pursuing?
Yeah, it honestly wasn't like that. It was like, this is so much fun, and every little thing you did was like, wow, we're actually making our own records. You know, like, everything we did was DIY. They still say that, right? Mm-hmm. Do it yourself, right? But it was out of necessity. It wasn't like, we're so cool, we're going to do, you know, we'd love to have someone make our t-shirts, but no one was willing to do that. So you had to do all your own stuff, right? We had to glue together our own record sleeves, because we got them printed, but we didn't have the extra nickel per sleeve to get it glued.
Oh my God.
So we were doing it. But it wasn't like it was a bummer. It's like, let's get a couple cases of beer and go to the bass player's house, and we'll just do it on Saturday or whatever. So
youth.
I know, right?
I'll be like, I don't know if I can fucking glue records. Yeah, pay someone to do that.
Yeah, and then we started playing in Berkeley, and that was really fun. That's where we first got a following and stuff. But it really took a long time, and it was just something we liked to do, though.
Do you appreciate the fact that you had to build this in a pre-social media era? I mean, now, not that social media is easy to figure out, but at least there is the potential for reach and a megaphone. But, you know, at that time, which I assume is probably the mid to late 80s, it's really just word of mouth at that point, right?
Word of mouth and cassettes.
Yes.
I think we did realize even back then that you're going to reach a lot more people with your little CD or your cassette than you ever are with a live show or by talking to somebody and stuff. So it was important for us to record stuff and get it out from the very beginning.
How are you getting it out, though?
Yeah, we send to fanzines.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you could buy cassettes at Radio Shack. They're like 12-pack cassettes.
I remember.
Yeah. So you could buy those for like a buck a piece, I think. You know, 10 bucks for 10 or something. And then you dub them on your cassette player at home.
Yeah.
And slap on the label and send it out.
It's kind of funny that philosophically, that hasn't really changed much. That people still... And it almost seems like the sloppier something is, the more homespun it is, the more authentic it is for people, because it's not, you know, if something's really shiny and polished, then people are automatically suspicious. But like, that's a corporation. You're trying to sell me a thing.
Yeah,
particularly
yeah.
if you're doing like thrash, if it's super packaged and super slick. So I wonder, when you guys did start to make it, did that affect your initial core group of fans who were like, fuck, you guys sold out because your album looks like someone printed it?
Yeah. Well, For sure, there's a little bit of that. I guess the, I think there's two sides of it, right? Where they're definitely, like you said, it almost makes it more meaningful if it seems flawed or imperfect, that sort of thing. And the other side of it is, whenever you hear a band's old record that sounds really shitty and is super cool, they were never trying to make it sound like that. They wanted to make it sound fucking great. That was the best they could do, right? And that's what we did. We had shitty amps and shitty production and stuff, and we were pretty excited about it. But and you can look back at it now and go, oh, that's actually pretty – that's kind of cool in its own way. Things can have a charm, right?
Yes. So how do you then – because I just, I see these, maybe they're not dichotomous, but it feels like there's a dichotomy to me between this artistic side, which, like you just said, you have, you know, like embraces flaws. A lot of the best stuff comes from flaws, and it's good to embrace your flaws, versus science, which is all about stamping out all the flaws, and it's very exact, and it has to, you know, the math has to check out, and the science has to be slick and perfect. Like, how do you see a disparity between those two things, or do you feel like they're just part of the half of the same whole?
Yeah, I mean, they say that, that music and math are very related, and a lot of people that are good at songwriting are good at math also, and I don't know for sure if that's true, but I think I do kind of see songs as things you can almost visualize them, I guess, right? If it's a certain chorus part or the way a harmony fits together and stuff. So I never thought about it being perfect or imperfect, but you're always trying to write like the perfect song, right? I think Weezer, they were talking about that, like the ideal of the perfect song. It's got to be out there somewhere, and you can never get to it, of course, but right, it's kind of a nice idea. It has just the right structure and all that stuff.
Yeah, but with science, you can't really just go, oh, well, I'll just embrace the flaws with this. Like, you really, when that happens, you got to start all over and you have to make it work.
Maybe. I don't know. I think sometimes things get fudged a little bit in science also, right?
You think, well, of course. I mean, it's whenever, how many times something has to be peer reviewed once it gets published and they go, you know, this just happened with Warp Drive a couple weeks ago, and a bunch of people said, how come you're not talking about Warp Drive? And I was like, because it hasn't been peer-reviewed yet. And once they do, it's probably not going to check out. And of course, what happens?
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
So it is – it's also interesting to see social media with science, because people can blurt stuff out without having – and most citizens will not take the time to thoroughly dissect and try to understand. They just see things on the surface.
For sure. I mean, that's the internet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of anti-science, the internet, I guess.
In a weird way. Right? I mean, I feel like the internet wants to embrace science and sections of it want to embrace science, but I feel like as a whole, the internet, the entity of the internet, just embraces whatever it sees on the surface in a moment and it's goes, okay, that's reality.
Very gossipy, right? So it's pseudoscience, I guess.
So had you completed – at what level had you completed of your education before you – and when did you decide to – break off for a while and then go pursue music?
Yeah. I mean, to not make it a long story, but the timeline is that, you know, after high school, we had just started the band. We knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, but it was fun. So, you know, a couple of us went to college. I got accepted to USC, and I decided to go for pre-med. I thought I wanted to be a doctor at the time. Right?
You could have been.
probably. But as time went on, I still, you know, I was going home every weekend to do band stuff. And that was just really important to us. And I knew that that's what I loved. And I figured I had to get a job eventually. But the more real medical school came, because it was getting closer and closer, the more I sort of started self-sabotaging a little bit, not sending in the applications on time and stuff like that. And then, whoops, I didn't get in. Like, well, I guess I'm going to do the band now, right? But I still didn't have a job or know what I was going to do, and I got accepted to graduate school. Now, graduate school is a great way to avoid reality in the real world. Enjoy. You can really stretch that out for a long time if you want to, right?
It is, and it's so amazing that, you know, I know there's value in continuing education, and there's value in graduate school, but it also, parts of it are like, that's a pretty good business model for the schools. Like, oh, no, you actually need more school.
Yeah.
If you want to be more respected, I mean, it's almost the educational version of like breath strips. Like, okay, you know, if you want people to like you more, you got to buy these things. And it's,
right.
And it is, when really we live in an age where you could learn anything from your phone. You could really learn anything in a moment. So attending, you know, this graduate school program does feel like, It feels half scammy to me.
Right. And, you know, and I'm saying that half jokey because I did like what I was doing and stuff. But part of my undergraduate curriculum was genetics, which is another word for molecular biology pretty much. So I decided that's the part of biology I liked the best. And so I went into that and kept on going. And it was taking a long time, but we were doing the band thing on the side. And then one day the band finally actually took off. So
what was that moment?
We started getting played on K-Rock.
It was K-Rock, right.
Come out and play, yeah, and which was amazing in itself. And then we heard that it was the number one most requested, like within a week, and then it went to MTV within 4 weeks, and it really went when it went.
I mean, K-Rock, because I was on air at K-Rock from 95 to 98, and so that was like that was a sweet spot for you guys, like mm-hmm. that period. And it seemed very advantageous that K-Rock had such a strong Orange County following that I don't think it was an accident that like so many Orange County bands, which were right in K-Rock's backyard and right in their audience, blew up. And then, you know,
right.
K-Rock was essentially K-Rock was like a subreddit. And if you got voted to the top of that subreddit, then MTV, like the rest of music culture was the front page. And it's like, oh, it got voted to the top of K-Rock. So now it's going to make the front page.
K-Rock and MTV were really connected because people that worked at K-Rock, as you probably know, went to MTV and stuff.
Yeah.
So that means you probably introduced one of our songs on the radio at one point, right?
Tons, because you guys were in heavy rotation. You guys were in very heavy rotation. So, and that meant that if I had a 4-hour shift, you'd get played twice. That's how that's how you knew a song was in heavy rotation.
Wow.
So it was an interesting. You guys were kind of gliding. Like I was there for the last sort of sputtering of grunge into the more like Orange County thrash rock, which was really, you know, like when I was there, that was really that was the time for it.
Awesome.
So was it literally one day you're like, oh fuck, we're on K-Rock? Did you know they were going to play it, or just Kevin Weatherly was his program director there? He just picked it and threw it on.
Didn't know. Actually, I got the call like half an hour before they played it. They said, hey, they had a music meeting. They played 15 songs and they rejected them all but yours. They were going to play it. Jed's going to play it on the morning or the afternoon drive or whatever. And
nice.
And so I know. And I was at school. I was in the lab, you know, like, I got to find a radio. I got to turn the radio on. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It was pretty cool. Yeah. So, I mean, and we still didn't know what we were going to do or how far it was going to go. But within about 2 months, it was going. I think the record had made the top 20, the album made the top 20. And it was time to, like, if you're going to do it, you got to go. You got to get on the road now and really go. So at the time, you know, our bass player he had a job he didn't really care about. Noodles was a janitor, a great janitor, by the way. But he was actually concerned. He had a daughter to take care of and stuff. And, you know, I was going to have to quit school. And, you know, my family was concerned about that. And, of course, my mom didn't understand, like, are you sure this is a good idea? You know, why are you leaving school for a punk rock band and stuff? But it all worked out. And luckily, pretty quickly, you know, a lot of bands, I think they're kind of in that that zone where you're not sure if it's really going to go for a while.
Sure.
And luckily for us, that didn't really happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were a ton of, you know, for every Offspring story, there's like a Dishwalla story. You know what I mean? Where it's like one.
Hey, I love Dishwalla.
I did too. But they had the one, you know, they had the one song that, I mean, from the K-Rock perspective, they had the one song that K-Rock played all the time. And then just didn't really, you know. I mean, there were so many bands that I remember even when Loser came out by Beck, I was like, well, this guy's probably never going to have another thing after that. And then, of course, you know, because it was such a lot of the songs K-Rock would pick almost felt like they just felt like very much like songs of the moment. Mm-hmm. So if a band could then have a second song and a third song that K-Rock would play, then you knew that band was probably going to be around for a while. But a lot of times it was just one song, and then K-Rock was just
the one. Just, and we got lucky that we got a second one and a third one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I guess that still happens now. Maybe it's just more gradual. Maybe, you know, maybe it's more like with the overnight thing the 10-year overnight thing. Though you work for 10 years, then you become an overnight success. But I guess YouTube is really the equivalent of that now, of someone just all of a sudden going viral. And then, but radio now, I feel like, yeah, they played their song on the radio. Oh, big deal, you know? I mean, is that still a big deal to get played on the radio?
I think it is, for sure. And people talk about the social media, which is super important, but I don't think the radio's not going anywhere. I don't think that's a big part of it. And I actually think it goes in cycles, and it's very singlesy feeling, I think, to me right now, right? And that happened in, the 60s? Happened in the 70s, of course, and then it became more band-oriented. The 90s, for sure, was a lot more like that.
Yeah, I just don't know if people really understand the idea of, you know, listen to an album the way that it was written, start to finish, and take the journey.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, I'll take this from over here, and then I'll just, now I have my own playlist.
You don't have to, and I'm playing, you know, video games the whole time also.
And also, when your song comes up, you know, like in iTunes, it's already telling people, like, well, you should listen to this other one over here. Like, it's already
onto the next,
directing you into, you know, to 10 other directions.
Yeah.
So I pulled this off your Wikipedia page because this is a phenomenal paragraph. As of 2013, Holland is a doctoral student at the Laboratory of Viral Oncology and Proteomics Research, Keck School of Medicine, where he is supervised. And then it has your supervisor's professor's name. March 2013, Holland and co-authors published a paper regarding microRNA and HIV genomes, titled Identification of Human MicroRNA-like Sequences Embedded with the Protein Encoding Genes of the Human Immunodeficiency Virus. So it says that this describes the use of computational molecular biology to identify microRNA-like sequences in HIV. So it's just, I mean, that fucking blows my mind. That blows my mind. You know the offspring? Yeah, they're still around, but that guy is sequencing RNA and HIV.
Okay, right. Yeah, well, thank you. I don't know. How to take that.
It's a huge compliment because when you quit school, most people don't go back to school. There's like, oh, I'll go back. So, I mean, yeah. I left school like in my final quarter to go work at MTV. And at the time I told my mom, like, I can always go back. I'm not going to go back to finish out my philosophy degree. But you went, like, something about you went back and decided that science was important to you.
I didn't think I was going to, actually. Especially because with the band thing, when it's going, it's like, you know, I asked my manager, I go, what would happen if I took a couple years off to finish school? And he's like, forget it. It's over, right? So I didn't for a long time, but then I realized I kind of could. And, you know, when I dropped out, I basically dropped out of school, right? And all I had to do was write the dissertation, which is a big job, but that's like three-fourths of the way there. So it always kind of bugged me, and it just kind of kept on bugging me. Like 10 years later, like, you know, I just didn't finish that. It's kind of a shame. It'd be cool if I finished it, you know. And I think it brings about other opportunities in a way, you know. I don't know what they are exactly, but, you know, maybe Bono will come calling or something, you know. Right? He's into helping out with the AIDS problem and all that.
It's amazing. Like, when I think about how you could fly yourself from the weenie roast to then curing AIDS. Like, your whole life is such an interesting tapestry of things that, you know, the reason that I'm leaning on it so heavily is because I want people to understand that what makes them interesting and what makes them unique is all the different things that they're into. And you were proving that you can do all of those things as far as you can possibly take them. It doesn't have to just be one thing. If you like music, you can take music as far as you want. And then you can also pursue science, and you can also pursue flying. And so it's, you know, there must be something about what drives you, or how you do that, other than, well, it just seemed fun. Like, you obviously, you seem like a chill guy, but your Wikipedia page would suggest that you're not a chill guy because you're into a lot of stuff.
I guess I just want to take it as far as I can go, you know, for sure.
So what is your doctoral program like now? What does it involve on a daily basis, and how does it play out?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, I had done the majority of the work, so I'd already taken the classes, and you have to take these really gnarly oral exams where all the professors try to make you feel like you don't know anything. And,
sure.
And it's a grilling process, hazing basically, right? That that's all kind of done. And USC was actually super, super cool when they said, you can come back even though it's been 18 years or whatever, and you can just pick up where you left off. No remedial work, just go ahead and finish. So that's been really great. And what I'm doing is mostly right now it's computational, which means I can do research on the computer and write it up. And I'm not reporting to the lab every morning, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So that way I can still do what I'm doing. I'm going on tour, and you know, the band's a very big part of our life, obviously. You know, Noodles, can you keep it down?
Most people are getting blown by groupies and you're sequencing RNA. Please, I'm sequencing RNA.
That's right. Cut with a beer bong already. I'm trying to read like Napoleon Dynamite. You guys, I'm trying to read my biology.
Keep it down on the bus back here. I'm trying to understand HIV better. I mean, from a scientific point of view. What is it specifically that you're trying to discover by sequencing the RNA?
Right. Well, I don't know how to detail to get it, right? Trying to keep it where it's...
Just say whatever you think. Yeah. And people, if they get it, they get it. If they don't, fuck them.
All right. I mean, I think genetics is super cool. There, I said it, right?
Yes.
It goes all the way back to figuring out what color flowers are going to be when you cross them and all that stuff. And different things come out at different times. Like when they discovered DNA was a genetic material, that was amazing in 1953. And then they discovered other things along the way. It was really cool. And one of the latest things in the last 10 years or so is they discovered this thing called microRNA. So they are RNA, which is like DNA, but a little different. But they're very small, thus the micro, and that's why no one discovered them before, because they were hard to see.
Sure.
They were very small. But what they do is they latch on to bigger RNAs, and by latching on, they shut them off. So it's essentially an off switch for your genes. And for your body to be healthy, you have to turn genes on and off. Sometimes you want to grow, sometimes you don't want to grow, that sort of thing. So the on-off switches are really important, and microRNAs are an important off switch.
Sure. And then, but it's never just as simple as shutting something off. Like, I would assume that if you start shutting things off, that it has an effect, because there is, you know, we are a holistic entity. And so if you start fucking with one thing, then something else could potentially suffer.
For sure. Right. So there has to be ways to shut off the off switch to turn it on. You know, that whole thing, it gets very, obviously super, super complicated. And I think viruses are really interesting. They're obviously, you know, a huge cause of human suffering, which is a great reason to look into them and see if you can figure something out. But there's also something about it that is just so evil. It's wild. You know, they're not considered living organisms because they can't reproduce by themselves. They have to infect you in order to make new copies of themselves.
Sure.
But and people probably don't know, like a typical virus will go, it'll latch on the top of your cell like a lunar lander. It injects its DNA, and the DNA tells the cell, don't make any more of your own stuff. You're now only going to make more viruses. It'll make like 100 viruses. And the last instruction is, now blow up. And then those 100 viruses go out and infect other cells. And that's so gnarly, right? It's like, that's incredible.
It basically sounds like Agent Smith describing humans to Morpheus in The Matrix.
That's where they got the idea.
Humans are a virus.
Right.
But it's from its point of view, it's just trying to survive.
It's just trying to survive, right? And that's just the arms race, right? But so what they do, what viruses do, is they figure out how to mess up what's going on in the cell. If a certain process is supposed to happen, they figure out how to hijack it or whatever. And so some viruses actually make microRNAs. They've somehow figured out how to do that, and they can shut off things in the cell that they want to turn off. So that's all pretty amazing. And we're trying to understand how microRNAs might be used in an HIV infection in its pathogenesis, and see if there's some way. Basically, we want to understand it so we can interfere with it.
Sure. So is it a question of duplicating a or copying like a white hat virus, where you essentially send a virus to attack another virus?
You can, if you know what a microRNA is and what it does, you can actually make an anti-microRNA. You can synthesize it, throw it in the cell, and it'll neutralize it.
And how far away are we, do you think, from really being able to use this technology?
They're doing that with certain liver diseases. I guess with the liver, it's an easier organ for people to mess around with.
Yeah.
So there's actually a couple of them for, I think it's hepatitis C. There's some drugs in development and stuff. They're actually anti-microRNAs.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing. It is, yeah, it's here. They're doing it. They just got to figure out how to do it with all the different cell types and viruses and what have you.
Do you teach it all ever?
No, no.
Because what's interesting about just listening to the way you, the way that you express what you're working on, and also what you said earlier about how sometimes you had to kind of dumb down your speech so that people would understand what you're talking about. You're expressing these ideas in very like, you're expressing science in hangout terms.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like, yeah, well, you know, this one virus is like a douchebag over here, so this other one's got it. Like, you explain in kind of, in just sort of colloquial language, like what's going on. I think you could be a very valuable teacher, or maybe a lecture series, or an app where you explain. I think people would listen to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think it's important. I think that's actually a part that's really, that makes school so difficult, is the people that know so much about it, they're so up in the language and all that, that the communication of it is not really very good. And that's what turns so many students off. But
sure,
if you did explain it like, so bro, this virus is gnarly. It fucking totally fucks up your cell, right? You feel like shit? This is why. I think that would actually engage students a lot more, wouldn't it?
Yes. Microbiology.
Yeah.
I think that's what you need to be teaching. USC needs to be a fucking building so you can teach these kids what's going on. Because I wonder what the margin of error is with people who, simply because they had a poor communicator as a teacher, that didn't understand something or didn't pursue something that they otherwise would have had an aptitude for if it just seems like a language issue.
It is a lot of times. I think even I've run across some people, I mean, and this isn't a diss on USC because USC has been really, really good to me. They've been great. But I do see sometimes in other people or professors, it's almost like, if you don't know this, you're just going to have to figure it out because I had to struggle with it and stuff. And so you end up going back to textbooks and that. So that can be very difficult. Like if you go to like, if you, your car has trouble and you go to the mechanic, if the guy would just explain it to you, you could probably do half of it yourself, right? But he's not going to help you. You got it. They're like, you're going to have to suck it up and figure it out and spend 1,000 hours learning how the carburetor works. And you don't do it. So I think that's what turns off a lot of people from fixing their own cars.
Sure. Well, there is that sort of like the previous generation struggle and be like, no, this sucked for me, so this has got to suck for you. But it doesn't have to. You know,
I don't know if that's what it is or what, but yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, I like to say it's not rocket science, and sometimes rocket science really is rocket science and stuff, but you can break down these things into simpler principles that are easier to understand.
Yeah. So I feel like you have a responsibility as an educator to put this information out. And then, so, you know, it'd be great. You could give a lecture and then like play a couple songs.
That's right.
This is perfect.
That's right. Right. Wow. It'd be like a Hare Krishna or something. You know, like
just start feed a compound. Them and
brainwash them.
Just start a compound. I mean, right. It's kind of interesting. I mean, like, it never occurred to me that the name of your band is a genetic reference.
I know, it actually is. Well, our first drummer went to UCLA, and he was also pre-med. And, man, he really, like, he had to get into medical school. Like, that was it for sure. So, eventually, he wasn't really showing up to practice, and it didn't work out. I'm still good friends with him, but he came up with the name, actually. So, it probably has something to do with his pre-med.
So, when you guys broke, was he like, fuck.
Oh, man. He said he had just started a residency in Pittsburgh and was, like, unpacking his TV in an apartment and turned it on, and we were on. It's like, oh, my God. But no, he's happy with what he's doing and stuff. He's doing some amazing cancer research, actually.
That's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
This is wonderful. Are you so what, like, when do you complete the PhD program?
It's whenever you finish, you know. I hope to finish in the next 6 to 12 months.
Oh, wow. Then what?
I know, exactly. Apparently I have to become a teacher.
You could. Just as a side gig, you know, six months of teaching, 6 months of touring.
Yeah. I'm really not sure where it's going to go. Remember there was that really cool Steve Jobs speech where he said he was into different stuff but didn't know what it was. And like, he really liked computers, but he really liked calligraphy. And it was years later that it came together as the what you see is what you get, where you have your fancy fonts on the screen. Yes. And stuff. And so I kind of see this like that, where I'm not sure where it's going to take me or where it all fits in, but we'll see.
But again, it's more about – I like the fact that for you, the actual PhD is sort of secondary to the journey of it, which I guess is, you know, I always try to convey this to people. It's like, you know, goals are they're sort of a roadmap. It's like they'll kind of point you in a direction. But what you become from the journey is like, that's the meat. That's the most important part.
For sure. For sure. And this one's been difficult in certain ways, too, because it's just a mountain of knowledge. So it's actually been pretty tough to get through all the material and stuff. But it's great. I'm getting there.
Is navigating the music business tougher than navigating science, or is it?
Those people are assholes. like I said, that journey was something that I loved. I loved every time. It's like, wow, you mean if I want to play your club, I just send you a cassette and then I call you 10 times until you let me play. You know, like that was a different kind of learning experience.
Yeah. Do you think you will always have music in your life, or do you think there's a certain point where you're like, I did that?
For sure. For sure. I mean, I liked biology and I like it even more now and stuff, but you know, I think when you're a kid, like the band thing is like, wow, that's a big deal, and that still hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
Yeah, we still love, you know, getting out on stage and playing and stuff, and I love songwriting, of course, and making records, cuz it's like you're creating something, you're watching it come to life, but when you play the shows, there's that immediate reaction of the crowd and stuff, and we're very lucky. We just played some shows last week and it was nuts. People just, you know, singing along. They know all the words and stuff. And they're young, too. I mean, they're high school age and whatever, and they're into it.
You know, you're the closest thing that the world has to a Buckaroo Banzai. did that ever occur to you?
I watched that movie like a year ago because I had heard references about it. I go, I got to see. It's kind of a funny movie, right?
Yeah, you know, like they try. They tried. It got weird. I mean, like the movie
is that
has,
funny? You didn't write it
problems.
Or something, right?
No.
It's kind of a funny movie.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's the concept of it. You're like,
if it was flawed, I'd write
it. No, it was flawed. It was definitely flawed. Yeah. It was a fun movie, but you know, rock star scientists. I mean, you know, yeah. it's you might hold the key to some type of weird dimensional portal.
Maybe. I'll see what I can do about that.
Did you take a significant amount of time off? Like at a certain point, did you decide, I can't take the music stuff anymore. I just need a break from it. I have to recharge. I have to kind of hole up for a while.
Yeah, we tend to do that after what we call like a record cycle, because you know, you spend a long time working on the record and then you're out playing for people, you know, so you can be on tour for, well, before you know it, it's 2 years, you know,
sure.
Two and a half years, because you've spent a year and a half making the record and a year on the road. So you have to recharge a little bit. We've never like taken like a full on year long sabbatical or anything like that. But you have to take time off. One thing that we do is when we go on tour, we don't go for 2 months at a time. It's just too gnarly.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to keep it to 3 weeks, and it ends up being maybe 4 weeks or something. Somehow,
right.
It always gets a little longer. But
some people really just love being on the road, though. Like, they can't – it's like, yeah, I own a place, but I'm never at it. You know, like, they're just on a tour bus all the time.
Yeah. I've heard, like, Bob Dylan did, like, 270 days last year or something like that.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I mean, God bless him. Good for him. That's amazing. But that's not me. I couldn't do that.
Do you have kids?
Yeah.
How many kids do you have?
Two.
Two kids?
Yeah.
Are they? Do they have an aptitude for either science or music that you've noticed yet?
Music.
Yeah.
Music for sure.
As a parent, do you feel like, because it's almost now where if you kind of force music too much, they're going to be, shut up, Dad, I want to be a banker, you know? Like, you got to be, or do you just sort of step back and let them figure out their own stuff?
I have a friend who decided that he wanted his kids to be cool with music. So he told them that country was really cool for a long time. Forced them, said, country's so great, so great, so that they would rebel against the country and,
yes.
And listen to good music. But no, I don't know. I mean, we have a 10-year-old, and she's really into the band, which is cool, because I know that that's going to change when they hit 12 or something. There's a certain age where there's just no way you can like anything your parent does, right?
Of course.
So that day's coming, but right now it's still okay.
Yeah, but when she's 16, she'll be the only kid in her class into, like, fusion jazz. It was like, I just, nothing rock oriented for me.
Right.
It just have to totally rebel.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that about country. I love classic country.
Okay.
Hated it when I was growing up because my dad listened to it in the car all the time.
Yeah.
And the fact that it annoyed my mom and myself, he thought it was funnier, so it was all, you know, I mean, like, it was all Waylon Jennings and all, like, really intense country. And now, like, I really... Current country music, I'm not so much fan because it's so much pop.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like a good country song now.
Right on.
It's so true, Dexter. Country music is so true.
Well, no, I mean, I can go as far as Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, for sure. No, I get it for sure. And there's a real, like you were talking about, just talking to the people. I mean, that's the ultimate format for that, right?
Yeah.
So,
how's your voice hold up now with shows? Because it's not you can be a little screamy sometimes, so that takes a toll.
It hurts. It actually does. My throat's pretty much sore all tour, but what are you going to do, you know? You see bands like, I'm trying to think of someone who sings really easy, like a Bublé guy, you know, like I Michael's really great. He's a really super nice guy and an amazing singer, but it's like, fuck, why didn't I sing like that? Why did I have to go out and scream at the top of my lungs?
Gotta keep them separated. Come out and play. Yeah.
Or it's like when you go and you see a comedian play and they show up, you know, because we have two trucks and the payroll is crazy and no one's making any money, and the comedian guy shows up with a stool and a glass of water.
It's
like,
great.
Fuck.
No, it's great. Yeah, I don't do sound checks when they're like, do you want to do a sound check? I'm like, why? I'm talking. Just turn the microphone on.
Yeah. That's awesome. All. You made a good decision.
Oh, it's just because all comedians want to be rock stars, but I also think all rock stars want to be funny. So there is, like, I think there is, we're on both sides of the fence going, it looks pretty rad over there.
Right. Yeah. I want a podcast.
You could do a podcast. You need to do a science podcast.
Oh, right.
This is how you can educate people.
Can I be your science correspondent?
Please. Please do that. I didn't mean to spit only, with excitement.
Only in bro talk, though.
Just bro talk. Yeah. Yes. I mean, this is really... I'm not kidding. We could do like a cool animation and then you could narrate and you could explain. You could explain RNA in bro terms. And I honestly think... I think there would be some people who would find it funny for ironic reasons, and then there would be bros who would be like, oh, fuck, that's sick. You know, like they would really understand it.
I like this. I think something's happening
this
here.
This feels like something that we need to be working on together. I'm very excited about it. I mean, it's so often, I think people, you seem to be someone who really does kind of live in the present. As what I mean is, when I said, what are you going to do when you're done with science? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what happens when I get my PhD. I'm just doing it now. Because like that's you living in the moment and enjoying it. And I think that's such a good takeaway. That's such a good way to live, because it's so stressful to fret or worry about what's going to happen in 12 months. I don't know what I'm going to do. And it comes from a good place of you're trying to protect yourself, but it creates more worry.
Yeah. Maybe. You know, I think because of what we do for a living, the band, like you're always thinking that, well, the band could be over at any moment, you know, which is true. It's going to happen. What happens to almost everybody, except the Rolling Stones, I guess. AC/DC's doing
or Dylan.
All right. Dylan, right? Still on the road. So maybe you just kind of have to live with that uncertainty. And I don't know, maybe that's even a motivation. Like, you know, time is short.
Yeah.
Get it done. Do what you can.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you haven't, I mean, like, are there any other fields or any other pursuits that you go, you know what, I'm done with this, I want to give that a try?
Maybe scuba.
Yeah.
I'd be kind of into that, yeah.
Scuba would be cool, because at least that's a recreational activity.
Yeah. Get you outside.
How often do you fly? Do you have to fly a certain amount every month to keep your license?
It's not really like that, but there are certain requirements to stay current or whatever, yeah. But I fly probably three times a week, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you fly to your own? Do you fly yourself to your own gigs?
Sometimes. Depends on how far and that sort of thing. And actually, a lot of times when we go on tour, I'll bring a pilot along anyway, because that's too many jobs,
right,
to do at once. But I really like it. I mean, you know, for some people, they have golf. That's kind of what I compare it to. You know, like it's like
I think flying a plane's a little more intense than golf.
Well, maybe. You don't want a hole in one flying, I guess, right?
What have you learned? I'm kind of interested to find out, like, what each skill set has taught you for your life. Like, what lessons has having to focus on being a pilot taught you, and how have you been able to apply? How have you been able to apply each discipline to everything else?
Yeah, you know, well, just to start off with that, I don't look at it that way. It just kind of, it all is what it is. I guess they're all different sides of me or whatever. But I think the thing about flying that is, that it teaches you is, you got to pay attention. Like, you got to be on your shit, you know, when it's time for that. And it's easy to kind of go through, because I do it. You go through a week, you're not really paying attention to where you're driving or whatever. But, like, this really gets you to, like, focus and pay attention and just, you know, be on your shit. And that's,
sure.
And I like that about that. I think that's really cool. And also, there's a great freedom to it and stuff. You know, when you, that's the reward, the payoff, is you're up there and you're flying. You know, you can actually fly pretty much wherever you want without talking to anybody if you really want to. It's not always the safest thing to do, but
sure.
But there are some times where, like, you know, I want to go to Vegas and I just want to go and don't want to talk to anybody. So you take off from the tower and you're on your own, and it's great. It's like the most amazing feeling in the world to be up there and you're flying your own plane and there's no one around. So
is it, so you're flying on instruments. So what is, does the plane fly itself for most of the way and you just have to keep it on course, or how does it?
Yeah, but I mean, you kind of do both, you know, it depends on what you feel like. Sometimes it's like, I want to drive the boat, just hanging out, you know, do some turns, look at the ground.
That's amazing. I just don't know if I'd be, I feel like I would get up there and then go, this is really cool. Wait, I'm stuck. What am I doing? I have to get down.
Yeah, I was flying, near Palmdale the other day and I looked out and I'm like, oh my God, that's a fucking drone. And there was a drone with like an F-16 chase plane that was like a couple miles away. They weren't coming to get me or anything. Oh. They just happened to be in the neighborhood. But I don't know. That was pretty amazing.
This drone thing, I just don't know how it's a viable path for humans to start littering the lower skies with devices. Like, it just seems like a horrible catastrophe waiting to happen.
Something's going
to
happen, right?
I mean, there's no way when everyone can have a drone and they start crowding the... Then something's going to cross into something, or they're going to crash in midair and land. Like, it just feels bad.
It's going to be bad because there's no regulation right now, but most of the drones don't really go that high. They probably go to 500 or 1,000 feet, and so most airplanes will be above that within a minute or so after they take off.
Sure.
So they're not quite in the same airspace usually yet, but they will be, right, as the drones improve. Have you heard a couple of stories where there's been drones where, like, a 737 captain saw one, like, pass off his right wingtip at, like, 8,000 feet or something like that? Like, yeah, really close.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, because people are obviously, you know, people are obviously going to push the limits as much as they can.
Of course.
And then something horrible is going to happen, and they're like, okay, now we have to, you know, it's sort of a... It's like regulation by disaster. Right. Oh, well, I guess we need a rule for that now because that just caused a horrible thing.
Well, the other thing that's different about drones is when you fly your own airplane, you have a really good incentive to fly it well, which is that you want to live, right? And you don't necessarily you're not thinking with the same sense of risk when you're flying a drone, or you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a drone is one step above a video game. Like, it's really barely not a video game.
Yeah,
and the fact that you know. There are basically a bunch of punk kids and weekend dads who have the ability to throw something into a flight path. It's very upsetting, and I try not to think about it. What do you think is the most important science thing going on right now?
Oh my gosh! I mean, there's so much stuff going on, right? I mean, drones is huge just because of how it impacts people.
Sure.
For sure. You know, I know my thing is molecular biology, but that really is, it's still kind of in this phase where it's really growing very fast.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about it in a way, like they say with physics, it's like, well, Newton figured out most of that stuff in the 1600s and then Einstein added to it a little bit, but that goes a lot more slowly, but they're literally finding things every couple years in molecular biology. So in biotech is basically what I'm talking about. So.
Sure. Because it's tied to that sort of, you know, it's tied to the kind of, bastardized version of Moore's law, right? So as your technology increases, then they will apply that and discover. I mean, does it just, you know, does it ever bend your mind to just think like, well, now, you know, now we know that there's this kind of like micro RNA, but there's got to be stuff under that, and there's got to be stuff under that, and it just goes that you know, that ancient Greek, like, it's just infinite, you know.
There will be something else, right?
Right.
I'm sure there will be. But, yeah, I just think it's amazing that, like, it's kind of like they're tinkering. Like, you can take a cancer cell and you can put it under a microscope and you can do your thing to it and you can kill it. Like, they actually have lots of ways of killing cancer, but they can only do it in a specific environment, like in a test tube or whatever. But even that they're at that point, you know, they're at the doorstep of being able to treat people for almost any disease. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that, you know, jumping from a petri dish to something like the human body is probably, you know, I mean, that does feel like a light year.
It's a leap, right?
Of a jump.
But you can see it there, which is really cool.
It's just right there.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything specific you want to plug the album now, or you want to plug anything before we let you go?
Right. Yeah, I have a hot sauce.
Oh, that's right. I read about your hot sauce.
I know. We didn't bring any today, did we?
Yeah, there's some right here.
Oh.
This is a fourth pursuit.
Yes, that's right. I just thought it would be cool to have hot sauce.
Someday I see this hot sauce being like having some type of molecular curative properties. It's like, you know,
right,
curing disease through hot sauce.
Yeah, I don't mix the two in the lab, right? Yeah, I started a few years ago, and my friends really liked it. I messed around with the recipe, and again, getting into something that I knew nothing about, so it took way longer, and you know, all that. But eventually, came up with something that people really liked, and so we just started putting it out there, and it's growing, it's doing good.
You know, but most people, and I know, because I feel like there are a lot of people, and I'm also guilty of this, but there's a lot of people that I know, and a lot of them are performers, where they it's almost like getting addicted to the rush of a new hobby. But then the second that the passion's going to go out of that pretty quickly, and then you just drop it and move on to something else.
Right.
But you actually follow through on this shit. I like hot sauce. I don't know anything about it. Now I'm just going to make hot sauce.
I'm going to make it, yeah, and see what happens, I guess.
Are people buying it? Where is it? Where is it available? Yeah.
We're in most supermarkets in the country. Not all of them. Maybe half.
You have the best fucking life.
and then Amazon, of course. If you can't find it in your local market, it's in Amazon.
We have some over. Yeah, where they brought you guys? These guys had sent some
Gringo
over.
Bandito.
Yes,
Gringo Bandito. That's right.
Gringo Bandito. Is this?
Yeah.
Is this an approximation of you on the cover?
That is. Yeah, it's sort of me as like a Pancho Villa
type
guy.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, so
you've been working on this since 2004.
Yeah, it's been that long. So we always say, you know, you might not like my band, but you'll probably like my hot sauce. Yeah, two shots, right?
Zero calories. You could just drink this stuff all day and it's still totally healthy, right?
That's what's so great. Yeah.
what do you recommend the hot sauce on? Do you recommend it on burritos, tacos, eggs, pizza? What's your...
Of course, all that stuff. It's really good on pizza. A lot of people don't think about putting hot sauce on pizza, but...
Oh, Tabasco on a cheese pizza is real good.
Yeah.
But now Gringo Bandito on a pizza will be even better.
You should try it. I like Tabasco. I'm like a hot sauce fan. A lot of people are kind of snobs, like, oh, I don't like Tabasco, it's too vinegary. But I really like them all. I think it's part of why I started making hot sauce.
Have you been to that hot sauce kiosk at the farmer's market over by the Grove?
Yeah, I think we're in there. Light My Fire?
Yes.
Yeah.
That place is amazing.
That's pretty cool, huh?
One guy just had a dream. Like, I'm going to every fucking hot sauce known to man.
It's great,
Under one.
Yeah.
Under one little roof.
Hot sauce is fun. It makes people smile, you know? It's like... Well, I mean, I wouldn't have started a salad dressing company, if you know what I mean. But
right.
Hot sauce, yeah.
Holland's Own. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Well, likewise.
I might seem a little excitable, but I just, when I meet someone that has that many, everyone is multidimensional, but it's just most people don't explore all of those to the fullest extent. It's just like they tinker a little bit. But I really do think that that's kind of, you know, that life is a bunch of separate little journeys that start to tie together in ways that you don't realize. Like, it's not crazy that in your pursuit of hot sauce, it could uncover something about one of the other things that you're working on.
Totally.
And then make a connection. Like, that's how you, that's where creativity and genius comes in, is that sort of interdisciplinary study. And so I think it's really cool.
Right on. Awesome. Thank you. I mean, yeah, there's a lot out there, right? The world is your oyster.
The world is your oyster. Pour hot sauce on it. If you want to use that, you could totally
can I make it
use
a slogan?
That gem. Yeah,
slogan.
You could totally use that gem. The world's your oyster. Make it spicy. I will not be offended if you decide not to use that. I completely understand. Are you? Where can people find you on various social media outlets?
Oh, right. Well, offspring.com, of course. Facebook, Twitter. It's all Offspring.
It's all Offspring stuff there, too.
We cornered all that years ago. Right?
Good thinking.
Yeah. We sued that kid in Modesto that had the Offspring. No, I'm just kidding.
Sued is a generous term. We beat the shit out of him. We took his website. But thank you so much for being here, Dexter.
Hey, thank you very much.
Really nice chatting
with
you.
It was really fun.
And goodbye, Noodles! We missed you.
I'll tell him.
Noodles, we're gonna hang out. Noodles, you're gonna come to shows.
You'd like him.
Now, normally we say at the end of the podcast, "Enjoy your burrito." Now we can say, "Pour some Gringo Bandito on that motherfucker and enjoy your spicy burrito."
Nice.
The end. Oh, that was so great.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.